This is VOA News. I'm Jim Bertel. The number of countries hit by the coronavirus climbed past 60 on Sunday, and infections and deaths continue to mount around the globe. In Paris, the Louvre Museum closed over concerns about the virus. AP Sarah Bassett has more.
Employee and union representative André Sacristan says workers fear being contaminated by the museum's flow of international visitors. Some were refusing to work. The shutdown followed a government decision to ban indoor public gatherings of more than 5,000 people. Sacristan says staffers were also worried by visiting museum workers from northern Italy who had come to collect works by Leonardo da Vinci on loan for a major exhibition. The COVID-19 outbreak, which began in central China, has infected more than 87,000 people globally and caused nearly 3,000 deaths. I'm Sarah Bassett.
Meanwhile, amid the biggest coronavirus outbreak outside of China, churches across South Korea were empty on Sunday. Reuters' David Doyle reports.
Across South Korea on Sunday, pews were empty, churches shuttered, and worshippers turned away, as authorities fight to rein in public gatherings after a spike in coronavirus cases. South Korea is battling the biggest virus outbreak outside China. On Sunday, it announced 586 new coronavirus infections, taking the total to over 3,700 cases, and the day before saw the country's biggest daily jump, 813 cases. That's prompted churches to act. For the first time in its history, South Korea's Catholic Church has halted masses at more than 1,700 locations. Buddhist temples have also called off events, while major Christian churches held online services.
That is Reuters' David Doyle reporting. For more on the coronavirus, go to voanews.com. This is VOA News. Fresh off his first victory in the 2020 Democratic U.S. presidential race, former Vice President Joe Biden is now looking ahead to Super Tuesday. AP's Shelley Adler has more.
Former Vice President Joe Biden says not only can he beat President Trump, he's the one, not Bernie Sanders, who can help the Democrats in Congress.
He'll have great trouble bringing along other senators, keeping the House of Representatives, winning back the Senate, and down ballot initiatives.
But Sanders, who came in second in South Carolina, says he's got the only message that can get the most people to the polls.
We are going to need the largest voter turnout in the history of this country. And I don't think you can do that unless you have a message that appeals to the working class and the middle class of this country who have been ignored too long by the political establishment, of which Joe Biden is part of.
Both Sanders and Biden appeared on ABC's This Week. Shelley Adler, Washington.
Afghan President Ashraf Ghani says his government has made no commitment to release 5,000 Taliban prisoners, publicly disagreeing with a timetable laid out just a day earlier in a U.S.-Taliban peace agreement.
Terrorism morphs. And the reason we insist in our discussions with the Taliban that they sever their ties with all terrorist groups, not just Al-Qaeda, is precisely because of this.
AP's Julie Walker has more on the agreement.
Under the deal signed in Doha, the U.S. draws down its forces from 13,000 to 8,600 in the next 3 to 4 months and pulls out the remaining forces in 14 months, depending on the Taliban meeting their commitments to prevent terrorism. If they don't, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says,
President Trump and his team will not hesitate to do what we must do to protect American lives.
More than 2,400 U.S. troops have been killed during the conflict. I'm Julie Walker.
Thousands of migrants and refugees are massing at Turkey's western frontier, trying to enter Greece. Reuters' Soraya Ali reports.
Thousands of migrants gathered at Turkey's border with Greece on Sunday, seeking entry after Ankara relaxed curbs on their movement. Turkey said on Thursday it would no longer restrain the hundreds of thousands of asylum seekers in its territory from reaching Europe, after an airstrike on Idlib in neighboring Syria killed 33 Turkish soldiers. The International Organization for Migration put the number of people along the Turkish border at 13,000. And some are already taking, at times, perilous journeys to Greece. The Turkish Coast Guard reportedly rescued some 50 migrants on Sunday after an overcrowded dinghy sank off Turkey's coast. Greece has said there was an orchestrated attempt to breach its borders and has accused Turkey of actively guiding migrants.
That is Reuters' Soraya Ali reporting. From Washington, I'm Jim Bertel, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
The opposition and the civil society organization decide to go ahead with the demonstration next week. The main issue, it's about his idea to organize a referendum in order to run for another term, while the current constitution doesn't allow him to have more than two terms.
Guinean opposition groups plan to step up pressure to prevent the government from amending the constitution.
The strategy we have adopted is something that has been developed over 6 years of engagement. So we have reverse engineered the fight against corruption from focusing on the judiciary and now focusing it on the bar. So the strategy is to get the bar to own up to this and fight it.
A Nigerian group launches a document to help fight judiciary corruption.
There is a report that recently came from the Montlande Commission, which encourages the police to be able to use peaceful means of crowd control. This clash and the attack on the youth by the police shows that the police has not yet graduated from the use of violence in crowd control. And this is what we are condemning.
And a Zimbabwean human rights group condemns the police for attacking civilians Saturday. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Guinean opposition and civil society groups have resolved to continue to pressure the government to stop plans to amend the constitution. It would allow President Alpha Conde to seek additional terms in office. At a meeting in the capital, Conakry, Saturday, leaders of the groups say they fine-tuned new strategies to combat what they say are efforts by the government to prevent nationwide demonstrations to protest constitutional amendment plans. For more, I reach attorney Tiano Sulemani Baldi, member of the National Front for the Defense of the Constitution, or FNDC, and president of the board of the Research Institute on Democracy and Rule of Law.
The opposition and the civil society organization decide to go ahead with other demonstration next week, since the president didn't call off the referendum. And the main issue, it's about his idea to organize the referendum in order to run for another term, while the current constitution doesn't allow him to have more than two terms. So next week, we are going to organize demonstration from March 5th, and then go ahead until he decides to give up the idea to organize the referendum.
Will you not be putting members of the groups who go on this demonstration in danger, since often it appears that your members clash with security operatives or the police when you go on demonstrations?
You know, it's always a difficult situation, since the government doesn't allow any peaceful demonstration, which is allowed under the constitution. We have had so far so many people have been killed, so many arrested, but the idea of the government, it's to increase the repression so that they will intimidate the people, they will harass them, and stop them from demonstrating. In that case, they will be able to go ahead, organize fraudulent elections, whether it's the legislative one or the referendum. So we know that there is always a risk, but we don't have any other means to let the government, to let the president the national and the international community to know that the majority of Guineans are against the idea to change the constitution. And it's unconstitutional. We, so far, we are trying to make all of the precautions to avoid any violence.
Bathiano, before the election was postponed for 2 weeks, Guineans were expected to vote on Sunday on a new constitution that the president defended as modern. It is expected that it will enshrine gender equality, prohibit female circumcision and the marriage of minors. It will also ensure a fairer distribution of the country's wealth in favor of young people and the poor, the president said. So why are you against this?
In fact, the president is making argument which cannot be justified in order to change the constitution. You know, if he want to, there is always the possibility to review the current constitution and maybe to include, you know, new ideas, new rights for the citizens. But saying that he want to have a new constitution because of the gender equality or, you know, it's nonsense. We have right now laws which are allowed to protect not only girls against genital feminine or to deal with the issue of redistribution. And keep in mind, so far we haven't had any president who let the corruption increase as he has done so far. So if he's concerned, it's how to deal with the life of Guineans. There are always other means to do so by making sure that the rule of law is consolidated in Guinea. But when he make those allegations, you make a comparison between the current constitution and the new one, you realize that we will be better off with the new constitution than the one he would like to put in place. So it's just one way for him to justify the idea for him to stay in power for life.
Attorney Thiano Sulemani Balde is the member of the National Front for the Defense of the Constitution, or FNDC. He spoke with me from the Guinean capital, Conakry. In Nigeria, the fight against corruption in the judiciary, or FIACIJ, is implementing measures the group says aim to weed out corruption in the judiciary. The move, leaders of the group say, is to ensure transparency as well as boost trust and independence in the country's judiciary. This following complaints from lawyers regarding reporting protocols and the lack of a formidable strategy to combat corruption within the judiciary. To learn more about efforts to fight corruption, I reach attorney Bayo Akinlade, national convener for the group.
This latest effort came as a result of we had sort of dying down of the activities we had had before with the previous chief judge, who had put in quite a lot of protocols to ensure that corruption wasn't going to be a problem in the judiciary. But now with the new chief judge, there seemed not to be strict protocol in the way we had done it before. So it was difficult to continue with the interventions we had under the former chief judge. So we had to come up with this strategy to keep the fight alive. Otherwise, we had a problem where people were going back to their old ways because the former chief judge had left the office.
Is there a strategy or contemplating on a nationwide strategy in your fight to root out corruption in the judiciary?
Yes, the strategy we have adopted is something that has been developed over 6 years of engagement, realizing that corruption starts with giving the bribe. Okay. Well, there are other forms of exploitation and other things, but in the legal profession, the word exploitation seems to be a very funny concept, because are you now saying that lawyers can easily be exploited? Lawyers are normally not supposed to be easily exploited. So we want to deal with that issue and say, let's forget the exploitation, because you are lawyers, you are supposed to be above exploitation. So what we are dealing with here is that the corruption in judiciary can only thrive where lawyers succumb to this exploitation. So we have reverse engineered the fight against corruption from, you know, focusing on the judiciary and now focusing it on the bar. So the strategy is to get the bar to own up to this and fight it.
Will the Chief Justice or the Supreme Court judges be drafted or be approached in this fight? Because if the fight is not won, it tarnishes their reputation and even the independence of the judiciary in Nigeria as a whole. What do you make of this?
We do not have to approach anybody again. I mean, all these courtesy visits and visits to all these heads of court are mostly a waste of time, because they've already made this statement. They make these public statements all the time. When they were being sworn in valedictory sessions, they always said, we're fighting corruption. Okay, what we need to do, we need to start to report. We need to start naming names. We need to start shaming people. We need to start standing our ground, making those sacrifices, and saying, no, we're not succumbing to the oppression. We're not succumbing to the exploitation. We're not supporting it to any form of exploitation or bribery.
No.
And we're going to start emphasizing that it is a crime to even give a bribe. So we're telling lawyers that you're criminals when you give bribes. When you now start stigmatizing lawyers, they now start waking up to their responsibility to ensure that they are gatekeepers in the temple of justice.
Is this why the fight against corruption in the judiciary has come up with a form by which individuals or those who work in the judiciary system can report people who are engaged in acts of bribe? Is this part of the effort?
Yes, that's part of the effort. We wanted to set up a protocol and say, okay, those that may not be able to make a call instantly, or you may not be able to send a message instantly, we have these forms that you can download, and or you can just print out, or can be made available, and you can just write out the incidents immediately, you know, as close as your memory can recollect the incidents. And you can just quickly do this and send it to us, because we're an independent body. Nobody is in control of me. Nobody is in control of the Bar Association. You can send it also to directly to the agencies that are concerned. And because it's a document that you write yourself.
Does that mean that there will be an independent and impartial inquiry into some of these allegations? Because, you know, other people can just make allegations just to entangle and make people uncomfortable if they don't like them one way or the other.
Yes. We said that we will look at this complaint independently, discreetly, and confidentially. And we will always be in touch with the complainant to verify the facts. That's why we have the phone number of the person complained against. He is there, his position, his title. We will make sure that all parties are notified of a complaint that comes up.
Bayo Akinladi is the national convener for the fight against corruption. He spoke with me from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos. Zimbabwean Human Rights Association, or ZIMRIGHT, has sharply condemned the police for attacking a youth group. This following clashes with people who had gathered at the St. Mary's home of Job Shikala, vice chairperson for the opposition MDC party. ZIMRIGHT says the police indiscriminately beat up people they had arrested following the night vigil. For more reaction, I reach Digmakai Berry, national director for the Zimbabwean Human Rights Association, or ZIMRIGHT.
We received the report that there were clashes between the police and youths belonging to the MDC, who were putting up at Job Scala's house. We managed to dispatch a team to go and observe the situation, and our teams managed to speak to four victims of police brutality, one of them who was seriously injured.
So what is the Zimbabwe Human Rights Association's reaction to this clash?
We condemn the actions by the police. Well, first and foremost, I think there is a report that recently came from the Montlande Commission, which encourages the police to be able to use peaceful means of crowd control. And this clash and the attack on the youth by the police shows that the police have not yet graduated from the use of violence in crowd control. And this is what we are condemning.
But they are suggesting that the crowd that held the vigil became unruly and the police were just there to maintain law and order.
We also, yes, did receive the reports that the young people who were at Job Scala's house, they started blocking the roads and burning tires. And we also condemn that kind of behavior. We think the appropriate action by the police would have been to arrest and not to assault. So there were seven people who were arrested, but besides simply arresting, the police went on to assault the people whom they had already arrested.
But we also understand that the clash resulted in the destruction of some property, including the stoning of a Zapco bus, and that prompted the police to fire tear gas. Supporters are saying that the police were just merely responding to the unruly behavior of these protesters, which resulted into this.
We can confirm that property was destroyed, and we can confirm that a Zupco bus was burnt, which is not acceptable, because I think it also then led to the escalation. Our monitors who were on the ground also confirmed that even after people had been arrested and were already in detention, the police then also went on to assault them. We do call on political leaders not to incite violence, and we also do call on young people not to be used for violence. But above all, we also want the police not to escalate the situation, and also to use peaceful means of crowd control, especially when they have already arrested people and they are already in custody. There is no reason for them to go ahead and assault those people.
Some Zimbabweans are suggesting that perhaps ZimRights could do a great service to the country by sensitizing young men and women across the country about the need to protest or go on demonstrations peacefully in order not to clash with the police, who by law are constitutionally backed to enforce and ensure law and order is maintained across the length and breadth of the country. What is your reaction to such assertions?
It's a good suggestion. In fact, last week, on the 20th of February, we were already in Weza, where we were already speaking with some of our members about the need to observe the law and to ensure that we all participate in avoiding violence. We need to understand that the clashes that are happening in Chitungwiza have been triggered by statements that came from the Zimbabwe Citizens Forum. So there's an organization called the Zimbabwe Citizens Forum, which has been tagged by Civicas as one of the anti-right groups, which threatened to go and invade the homes of MDC legislators whom they are accusing of calling for sanctions. What this caused is that young youth from the MDC then went on in a preemptive mood to camp at Honorable Job Scala's house as a way of preventing the threats that had been issued. This amounts to hate speech, and it is condemned in the strongest terms. So we condemn the violence that was done by the youth. We also condemn the violence that was done by the police. But above all, we condemn statements by citizens or whatever private actors and the right groups that are meant to trigger violence.
Dikamai Bere is the National Director for the Zimbabwean Human Rights Association, or ZimRights. He spoke with me from the capital, Harare. The Tanzanian ruling party, the Chama Chama Pinduzi, or CCM, has expelled one of its prominent members, Bernard Membe. Membe served as the Tanzanian foreign minister under President Jakaya Kikwete. His expulsion came after the party accused him of indiscipline and violating the group's constitution and ethics. Meanwhile, the party also accused former Secretary General Abdul Rahman Kinana and Yusufu Makamba of breaching the group's leadership and membership ethics. For analysis, I reached Dr. Darius Mukiza, a political communication specialist from the School of Journalism at the University of Dar es Salaam.
Let me say that every political party has its own rules, principles of how they should govern their political party. And it's not the first time either from CCM or from opposition political parties to tell people they say they have went against the morals of the party. Can you say that what you have been told by the political party will stand? And since it stands, I think now it is another chance of maybe either to accept the ruling of CCM and the CPSA on another path. It's unfortunate that Mr. Membe has not publicly spoken, but what I can say that I think on the side of CCM, he has acted according to their rules and the principles of their political party.
Mr. Membe said when he spoke with a media house in Tanzania that probably because of his presidential ambitions, that was why the decision to expel him. But do you think the CCM was justified in expelling him?
Well, let me start with a statement which Member said that it was because of his ambitions to vie for a presidential candidate in the coming election. So those words the public are here say. Are here say because Member has spoken. We don't have the facts about what I said. But on the side of CCM, the governing party here, which is CCM, of course, with its cabinet committees, said they came out with a stance that now Mr. Membe has misbehaved because he has a bad his reputation, the party, in terms of morals, has exceeded it to what they think now is not supposed to be in the party. So they said it's not the first time for him to violate the ethics of the party. They said now it's the fourth time. So that's their stance. But what has been said by Membe that because of the ambition plan for the CCM ruling party, no one knows that. We are not sure because Membe has spoken. No one can validate. Even Membe also has not validated using what fact.
What do you see as the political future of Bernard Membe? Do you foresee him joining the opposition after being expelled from the CCM?
So far, we have said that now Membe is free. He's no longer in the CCM or whatever. Now, he has not come out to speak. Though some political parties like the Civic United Front Party of Professor Lumumba has welcomed him. And we are not sure if other political parties like Chadema, which has in the past years has welcomed political parties, so political officials from DCM, will invite him. So far, I'm on my side. I'm predicting that Mao Membe will decide his path. And maybe his decision could be made soon because he said he will speak. So we are waiting for him. But I can say, maybe when reading through social media, he says his ambition to become the president of the United States of Tanzania has not stopped. Maybe he's planning either to form a political party or planning from other political parties. It is a ratio of let us wait and see.
Do you think that he could go back to the CCM?
Maybe let me say that we have cases where some of the members of CCM were expelled from the party, they stayed silent, and later were forgiven by the political party. But now it depends on member then, on how he will behave, on how he will choose, they say, to ask for a pardon. So now we cannot anticipate, unless Mr. Membe comes out and says something, but at least I am sure the CCM has about two cases where some of the parties, members of the parties, spend the political party and later we return to the political party. So now it is up to Membe now. It is up to Membe. If he thinks he still wants to impeach him, it is up to him now to behave and ask for a pardon. But so far, so good now, we don't see those symptoms for now. We don't see them because members have not spoken. But once he speaks now publicly by calling the press conference or whatever, now we shall be able to be in the position now of analyzing his words his stance and the way forward in his work in the future of politics in Tanzania.
Dr. Darius Mukiza is a political communication specialist from the School of Journalism at the University of Dar es Salaam. He spoke with me from Dar es Salaam. This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, and music from our African collection. But first, the Gambian police have arrested 15 people following an attack on the Guinean embassy. An angry Guinean crowd stormed the embassy and ransacked properties before setting it on fire Friday. It followed growing opposition to President Alpha Conde's move to extend his mandate to another term. Pan Derimbay has been following the story and has more from Raleigh, North Carolina.
An angry mob attacked the Guinean embassy on Friday. The ambassador and his staff were in the building when the rioters stormed the property. Heavy stones and other deadly objects were thrown into the property. The incident happened hours before the postponement of the scheduled Guinean constitutional referendum. Some sections of the Guinean community in the Gambia said they are opposed to President Alpha Conde's move to extend his mandate. They resorted to attacking the embassy. Assistant Superintendent of Police Lamin Jai is the spokesperson for the Gambia Police Force. Jai explains to VOA how the rioters entered the embassy.
Two female individuals came to the gate and inquired from the guards that they needed their ID card. They asked for ID card that they wanted to pick from the embassy. And so when the guards opened the gate, then a whole group of people stormed into the compound and then they started vandalizing property inside the embassy compound. So they called for reinforcement and our officers came over there to reinforce them and eventually put the situation under control.
Embassy staffers fled the property in fear for their lives. Vehicles and other valuables were not spared during the attack.
From what we understand, they have destroyed some files or some document papers, and it was these files that were burned. They also set fire on some of these files and documents in the premises of the embassy. And also they have vandalized the windows and windscreens of some vehicles that are inside the embassy compound.
Some security analysts are of the view that the attack on the Guinean embassy was a breach of security and negligence on the part of the Gambian state. But the police spokesman disagrees.
The embassy security is a priority for the Gambia Police Force. And so we've ensured that all ambassadors in the Gambia or embassies in the Gambia, we've got 24-hour security within all these embassies. And so to say that we have not taken cognizance of security of embassies would not be what anyone should go by, because if you look at our security, we've beefed it up in all the embassies and ensured that they are all 24 hours secured accordingly.
The police spokesman has appealed for calm. He says the Gambia will not tolerate lawlessness.
The Gambia will not allow, especially the Gambia Police Force, will not allow anybody to take law into your own hands for any reason, being a citizen of the Gambia or non-citizen of the Gambia, especially when it has to do with jeopardizing the peace and tranquility of the country. So we urge the Guinean community to observe restraint and follow procedure, the due processes of laws and regulations, especially those ones living in the Gambia, to observe the laws of the Gambia.
Already, 15 people have been taken into custody. They are currently helping the police in their investigations. The Guinean ambassador was contacted for comment, but he said he was busy attending to some police investigators at his office. For VOA Africa, this is Pan Derimbay reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
UN-mediated political talks aimed at resolving the crisis in Libya have ended in disarray, with nothing accomplished except an agreement to meet again next month. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The talks got off to a shambolic start. Before the first round of Libyan political negotiations even began, members of opposition warring groups suspended their participation. UN envoy to Libya, Hassan Salameh, acknowledges that caught him off guard.
We were surprised the day the meeting was supposed to start that some people had to leave because they were asked to. However, those who stayed decided that the occasion was too rare and precious, and therefore that the political track should start with those who stayed in Geneva.
Libya has been in a state of crisis ever since rebel military commander Khalifa Haftar attacked Tripoli last April. The military assault on the capital and seat of the internationally recognized Government of National Accord has killed more than 1,000 people and displaced hundreds of thousands. The UN has been pursuing three parallel negotiations. The resolution of Libya's crisis hangs on the continuation and outcome of those military, economic, and political tracks. Salameh says the economic financial track is going well. But the military track is in trouble because the warring parties continue to violate a temporary ceasefire. That, he says, is having a serious effect on the political negotiations. During the past week, he says many areas have been hit by shelling, including the Tripoli airport.
Many areas of the capital have been also shelled. It is clear that neither one of the three tracks can move positively while the cannon is doing what it is doing right now.
Salameh is calling on the two sides to respect the truce they had accepted last month during a summit in Berlin. He also is calling on countries of influence, including those that are intervening in Libyan affairs, to put pressure on those that violate the ceasefire and on those that violate the UN arms embargo on Libya. A United Nations report names Jordan, Turkey, and the United Arab Emirates as chief offenders. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's One Man's Point of View with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Anyone who has followed closely the exchange of views between Ethiopia and Egypt regarding the functioning of the Grand Renaissance Dam would not have been surprised that Ethiopia had decided to delay its attendance in the last phase of the negotiations in Washington, D.C. From the very beginning, Egypt criticized the construction of the Grand Dam on the basis that Egypt needs 95% of the Nile water to survive, and that 80% of that flows from the Stibit, the Blue Nile, which flows through Ethiopia. Ethiopia had given full assurance to Egypt that the operation of the dam would not in any way affect the flow of Nile water to Egypt. Nevertheless, Egypt has always insisted that Ethiopia and Egypt should negotiate, and Ethiopia had agreed. But Ethiopia had rejected proposal by Egypt that third parties should participate in the negotiation to resolve difficult technical issues. So it was a great surprise when Ethiopia accepted the good offices offer made by the United States and joined in a negotiation with Egypt and the Sudan. The U.S. in turn convinced the party to bring in the World Bank to provide the usual technical assistance to resolve those difficult technical issues. Egypt wants Ethiopia to stretch the time within which it will fill the Grand Renaissance Dam. Ethiopia, on the other hand, wants the shortest period of time to fill the dam. So this was the impasse that was to be resolved by the good offices extended by the United States. Now, behind the scenes, there was those who were worried as to why Ethiopia had agreed to use the good offices of the United States, particularly after the United States published its Palestinian plan. There were discussions that the United States could not be seen as an honest broker. And perhaps Ethiopia, throughout these talks, may have detected that the plan that should have been presented to the parties at the end of February was one which would not be completely harmonious with its interest. The first hint about this came when Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed paid a visit to South Africa. He then called on President Ramaphosa, who was becoming the new chairman of the African Union, that he should pay some interest in the issue of the Grand Renaissance Dam. Now, the response of the Ethiopians when they announced was very strange in a sense. One of the announcements was that Ethiopia would never accept any terms that would be contrary to its fundamental interest. But another said that the reason why Ethiopia was not going to the meeting was because it had not yet completed all its negotiations. The Egyptians have not yet made any comments, perhaps because of the death and funeral of former President Hosni Mubarak in Egypt. And the Americans have also not made any comments. In the meantime, it will be prudent for the African Union to begin to examine whether or not it could play a role to promote an agreement on the modalities that could enable the Grand Renaissance Dam to start functioning. This will be a contribution that the African Union could make, either alone or joining the mediating role in Washington along with Sudan, Egypt, Ethiopia, and the United States and World Bank. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent. You're hearing Esambi by Kanda Bongoman, and then Mwai by Oliver Ngoma will follow next, and then Bibi by Malo. I'm
Home. I am missing my baby. Hello, baby. natamani niwe nyumbani, nimekwama hapa njiani, kuna jam baby.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, producer Douglas Mpuga, and our engineer for today, Nelson Lopez, we say thanks for joining us. I remember, as the elders say, the fool is thirsty in the midst of water. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.